Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Ellefson with the Digital Education Podcast. We're getting ready for the holidays, and it's end of semester time, and hear stories about celebratory breakfasts and, you know, just enjoying heading into the season. And today I'm with Dr. Derek Neal, who is William C. Norby Professor in Economics at the University of Chicago. He studies labor, black-white wage inequality, economics of crime, and education policy. And he just published a book titled Information, Incentives, and Education Policy, which is why I want to talk about him. But I got to know Dr. Neal as a parent at a school I was at, working at when I was in the southwest side of Chicago. And so, Dr. Neal, it's great to be with you. Thanks for spending this time with me. But it really kind of to get us started and to get us rolling in this conversation a little bit, I'm really interested in how a professor of economics got interested in education and using economic modeling to improve conversations and policy in the education world.
Well, if you look at spending in modern economies, the amount as a fraction of GDP that is spent on education by governments is quite large relative to other types of spending. The U.S. spends more on healthcare, but I think that's the only broad category that we spend more on than education. And so if you look across the developed world, we spend between 5 and 10% of national income in developed countries on education services. And that's, you know, just the K through 12, not to mention what we spend on higher ed in terms of subsidies. So it's a huge part of government activity in modern countries. And every other area where government spends this much amount of money, economists have stepped in and asked the question, what would be the right way to spend the money? What would be the right set of mechanisms to use to buy and sell goods for the government of this order of magnitude? And so, you know, when we have military procurement, there are people who work on how to run the procurement auctions. When we do large infrastructure construction projects, there's a whole set of scholars that work on what's the right way to run the auction to make sure that we get a bridge that won't fall down for the least cost. And there are many people that work on what's the right way to set up the institutions and structures that government uses to spend subsidies or direct payments in the healthcare sector. And so I just felt it was important for someone to say, what have we learned through those inquiries that could be applied to the question of how do we design the systems and the policies that govern how we spend public funds that go to provide K through 12 education.
So you wrote the book primarily as activities and exercises for your students to kind of do the economic modeling in regards to, you know, the spending. One of the things that I'm wondering about is, you know, your students are economics, you know, degrees, they're focused on those. Like, what is the response, or what are some of the most hotly debated conversations that you have about what the economic modeling tells us versus, you know, kind of what we naturally believe, or maybe even believe to be true, which is actually the modeling might show us is actually wrong. You know, so what do you discover in the class through these conversations and through these activities?
Well, the theme of the class is that the key problem that frustrates people of good intentions that work on policy in this area is hidden information. If you think about the job setting for many, many people, they work in proximity to their boss, or their boss sees work product, or the boss works with them in a team environment. They're closely monitored. This isn't everyone in the economy, but it's large numbers. And then there are people who might, you know, work in sales, or they might work in an environment where they're in charge of a franchise, and then there's profit loss statements at the end of the quarter. And in all of those settings, there are kind of natural ways to think about monitoring whether someone's doing a good job or not. But when a teacher teaches a class of students, they're there by themselves. And it's very costly to do direct monitoring. Even if you put cameras in the classroom, you'd have to pay someone who knew how to teach to watch all the video. And I've always thought it was a little bit silly to think that you could have a principal pop in the back of the room three times a year and really get a confident reading on how well this teacher was performing day to day. And so there's a huge problem of not knowing the actions of the teacher, so that you don't really know as a taxpayer what you're paying for. The other problem is that you can't simply solve this by handing out vouchers, because there's another hidden information problem. And that is that the taxpayer does not really know the intentions, the motivations, the capacities of parents. And there are some parents out there who, when given the choice, would choose a school that was academically inferior for their child if it saved them 5 minutes a day of commuting time. And there are some parents who would pick a school that was academically inferior if it had a better baseball team. And there are some parents who would seek to do the very best for their child, but are not very well educated and could easily be convinced that a certain school was actually a good school academically, when in fact it was failing academically. And so if you just hand out vouchers and you have no accountability system to kind of shape the menu that parents choose from, research in various domains, especially this recent experience we've had in Louisiana, demonstrates that some parents will make really terrible academic choices for their children. But the final hidden information problem that makes this really tough is that well-intentioned parents see things that no one else can see. The reason you want to give parents vouchers is that they know whether the child comes home motivated to learn. They know whether the child got beaten up at school. They know whether the child is being encouraged to be an honest person that treats others well. They see all of these things that are very important for human development and for safety and for a sense of well-being for their child that don't show up on a test score. And so when education authority looks and they see a parent in a choice system choose a school that appears not to be the best school academically for their kid within the area where they live, they can't be 100% sure why. Did they choose it because this is the place where their kid is safe and doesn't get beaten up after school? This is the place where their child has really learned to be confident and to be caring and to really be a person that is skilled socially and has improved ethically and is just all around becoming a better person? Or did they choose this school simply because it's 5 minutes closer? And what that means is we're in a situation where the taxpayers can't know what's going on in any given school. We can't solve this by just handing out vouchers because not all parents can make informed choices for their children, or not all are willing to work hard enough to make informed choices for their children. And we can't simply audit parents kind of constrain the choices of some parents, not only because that would be politically infeasible, but because the reason it would be politically infeasible is that a lot of parents are making choices that look strange to an outsider that are perfectly defensible. And so in a world where there's all this hidden information about hidden actions and hidden motivations and hidden aspects of quality, how do you do the best you can in terms of making sure that when the government gives money to a charter school, to a traditional public school, or to a voucher program, that you're getting as much education services in terms of building real skill as you possibly can for the dollar that you spend?
So let me ask a question before kind of go into some of what you've learned or discovered about the policy, but just about, you know, kind of using this and, you know, in some ways I appreciate, you know, the approach that you take in the book of saying, hey, let's dig into this. Let's ask the questions. Let's discover what some of that hidden information tells us or what we can learn more so that then we can discover, because, you know, there's certain things that maybe ideologically I'd like to believe in that, you know, you challenge through the economic data. How, can you just give me a kind of an understanding, and for people who may, you know, who go read the book or people who are listening to this podcast, is how do you use, you know, kind of that economic modeling or data? You know, what are the tips that you would give somebody as they read through this and even prep their own minds to think critically about some of these things? And then I've got a question for you about policy stuff.
So the actually, that was what I was trying to do with the last answer. I don't think a layperson is going to be able to kind of pick up some books at the library and learn the mathematics. But I would always hold up the book when I taught the class, and I teach this class by asking questions. They read the book, they read other readings, and then I ask questions and I keep score with the quality of the answers. And often when I'm getting blank stares, I'll hold the book up with two hands by the top of the book so that my fingers touch the beginning and the end of the word information. And that's my signal to them that the answer is always, where's the hidden information? And is there a way to get around the problems that are caused by hidden information? So if the only thing that you cared about was the academic achievement of students in math and reading, then the paper percentile system that I developed and proposed in a journal article and then explained in the book, if that's all you cared about, that system would get you a long way towards the best you could possibly do if you implemented it carefully. And the reason is, it's a mechanism that answers the following question. If all you cared about was math and reading scores or some measure of achievement that we can rank, and you knew how much you cared about math versus reading, then how would you set up a contest that would get the educators to compete to provide math and reading skill in their students? And the paper itself says, suppose we're in an environment where people can manipulate the scale of test scores. Suppose we're in an environment where people can coach and run test prep sessions rather than really teach. Suppose we're in an environment where, as we saw in Atlanta and other cities, teachers aren't beyond changing answer keys, et cetera. Suppose we're in an environment where all of this form of hidden cheating or hidden gaming is possible. Is there a system that would eliminate the opportunities for that behavior and provide incentives for everyone to compete by actually teaching for deep mastery? And paper percentile is the answer to that question, if you can see the contest correctly and if you can have the new testing agency and the third party monitoring of the test remain free from political corruption. I kind of assume a third party testing agency that's new to get around that problem. But so the point is, you identify what are the hidden actions that educators engage in that harm students. And then you ask, can we design systems that either A, eliminate the opportunities for those actions, or B, make the incentives for teachers such that it is not in their interest to choose those actions.
So how would, you know, you tackle a little bit in the book, how would something like the pay for percentile plan, you know, that you propose, how is that a little bit different than like merit pay and some of the systems that people have tried that have generally, I mean, for the most part, failed?
Well, the merit pay is often tied to a target. And it's going to be a target level of scores among your kids, or it's going to be a target level of evaluation from your supervisors, or it's going to be a combination of the two. And a big point in the book is that education schools are built around the notions of standards. They're built around learning standards. They're built around professional standards. They're built around this notion of we write down what the standard is, and then the goal is to hold people accountable to that standard. And it all sounds very rational, but everything that you ever see in an ed school that somebody calls a standard is manipulable. And so one of my favorite stories is talked about in the book. In the United Kingdom, they had you could call it a form of merit pay, or if teachers put in a proposal that documented that they were an excellent teacher, then they could be put on a new step schedule. They not only get a raise this year, but have a new schedule thereafter. And it was a very involved packet that they had to put in, and they had to show in the packet that they were truly excellent, et cetera. And ex post, about 90% of teachers applied, and about 90% of the 90% that applied, I don't have the numbers exactly right here, but this is very close, received the award. And so ex post, we were living in Lake Wobegon in the British Isles, and that, you know, all teachers were above average. And that is very common if you read the literature on evaluation in large companies, evaluation in large government agencies, relative to these type of standards. The word is often called leniency bias. And so as long as people in education schools that have EDD behind their name are in charge of designing the accountability systems, they're not going to work, because they're going to be built around concepts that are easy to corrupt. It's very hard to take a set of test scores from thousands of students on a series of assessments that have overlapping items but all different forms, and figure out a formula for saying, this kid is proficient, this kid's not proficient, this kid is excellent, this kid's not excellent, this kid needs improvement, this kid doesn't, this kid is failing, this kid is not. To find the lines that would break up the distribution that way is very hard to do correctly when you're trying your best to do it correctly. Anything that's hard to do correctly when you're trying to do it correctly is easy to do wrong on purpose without being caught. You just do it the 10 different ways you could defend in court, and you pick the one that's most favorable to the group that you want to represent, and that's the way you do it. So if you're in bed with the teachers' unions and you want lower standards so that there's less pressure, then you find a way to equate tests and set proficiency lines that lower standards. And we saw tons of this in No Child Left Behind. In 1 year, in Illinois, eighth grade proficiency in math went from 54% to 78% in 2005 to 2006. And it just happened to be a year when the sanctions associated with AYP ratcheted up. And so the insight of what I proposed is that if you have contests where there has to be one winner and one loser, there is no way to manipulate the system so that all teachers are above average. Because every contest between teachers has to have one winner and one loser. And then the challenge for the designer is to make sure that the contests are fair, that teachers who are working with kids with learning disabilities don't compete against the teachers who are teaching the most advantaged kids in the honors classes, et cetera. But you're never going to get anywhere on having a decent accountability system as long as the psychometricians and the educational researchers are in charge of building it, because they build according to standards. Everything they do is, let's talk about the standards, let's align everything with the standards. And what that does is, if you had drugs where you could force everyone not to engage in gaming and cheating, et cetera, you would have a set of scores across schools and across time that always meant the same thing on a given assessment, because that's what psychometricians know how to do. And people in ed schools know how to write questions that reflect standards. But what it does in actuality is it creates an incredible amount of predictability in the system, so that when you build accountability systems around those standards, people know how to coach kids rather than teach them, so that they can move their scores by running test prep sessions. People who have an in with the people that are actually scaling the assessments know how to water down the proficiency scores without being caught. And you invite abuse. And so if we're ever going to make any progress, we have to make a commitment to two concepts. One is that we develop a completely separate set of assessments that we use for accountability. And that set of assessments will never have scale scores attached to it. Each year, it will just have ranks. There will be a percentile score, and that will be it. And there will never be any way to know whether a kid that got a 95th percentile score on the accountability test in 1 year knew more or less algebra than a kid that got a 93 in another year, because we have designed the system to always cover algebra, but to never be predictable in the way that modern assessments are, to never have this consistency and uniformity in the way questions are written, so that you could read the curriculum guide and know how they're going to word the question. And it would take a lot of work. It would take a commitment to a new type of test development to build assessments that you could roll out on a large scale that had this property. But I would point out that we do it all the time in places where we really care in higher ed. So the most serious effort that academics in major research universities ever give to grading of exams are PhD qualifying exams. And, you know, the core exams in my department are, you know, quite famous. Those exams are exams where everyone studies the exams from previous years, but not because they think any questions will ever be repeated, not because they think there's a format that's going to be used to ask the questions the same way, not because they think we could ever put the scores from this year's core exam on a scale with the scores from last year's core exam. They study the past questions because they're good questions that deeply probe the material. And when we grade a core exam in a given year, we're just looking at the ranks. And we have a vague notion apart from ranks about what acceptable performance is in levels. But if we see that everyone did poorly because this exam was a little harder than we thought, we don't fail a huge bunch. We adjust because we know that it's important to give these exams in a way that they're not predictable. So we don't give the same test every year. And every college class you ever took was one of two things. It was from a guy that recycled the same test every year, and then there were groups where they were fraternities or the baseball team or wherever. There were groups that had copies of all the old exams, and everybody studied the old exams, and then everybody went in and had memorized the answers. And the grading there was very precise. The grades meant the same thing every year, but it was a terrible way to teach because you were giving incentives for people to approach learning the wrong way. And then you had classes where the guy announced up front, everything's on a curve, and we're going to just push you to explore this deeply. And usually the questions were so hard that no one would have wanted to defend the grading in court, but everybody worked harder and learned more. And as long as we keep letting the psychometricians and the ed stats people develop the assessments that are used for accountability, we will have a world where people don't approach mastery and people don't work at it the way they should. And there's a chapter in the book that, you know, talks about this and puts the picture of the CPA exam up. And the uniform CPA exam has all the bells and whistles of the new tests that were developed under Race to the Top in the Obama administration. And they had 1 year after they introduced all those new computerized bells and whistles, the proficiency rates went up, the pass rates went up from the low 40s to the low 50s in about 5 years. And then they dropped 7 or 8 percentage points in 1 year. And the only thing that changed was they changed the formatting of the screen on the computer terminal. They didn't change anything about the curriculum or how they were supposed to ask the questions. They changed the screen. And then the leading test prep service put out an ad that they had come up with a new software package that would replicate the exam day experience, and the scores started going up again. And if we had kept the pressure that we had under No Child Left Behind after we went to these new exams, after we went to Every Child Succeeds, we would have just had computer labs in the basement of every school so that we had expensive coaching rather than inexpensive coaching. But you can't have a situation where you say, we're going to reward people for hitting a standard, because psychometric standards, educational standards, all the standards are things that can be gained. And the only thing that can't be gamed are contests where somebody has to win and somebody has to lose. And if you have rankings, some kid had to be the best kid in this contest group and some kid had to be the worst. And some school in this district had to be the best school and some school in this district had to be the worst. And 50% had to be above average and 50% had to be below average. And until we make a commitment to do accountability that way, it's not really worth doing.
So
in terms of handing out any money or punishments or real pressure associated with it.
And that's part, like the dual part of the book too, right? And part of what you're working on and part of one of the statements, you know, kind of like concluding statements that you make is that policymakers must combine efforts to promote, you know, these well-designed accountability systems, but within the efforts to promote competition. So like you create the accountability systems and you're right. You know, the commitment to accountability systems like you're talking about aren't really there. But, you know, if we create the accountability systems and then combine it with competition, you see the opportunities then for people to make better choices with more information. Is that kind of the gist of what I'm understanding?
Yeah, the idea is that you would use something like pay per percentile to get performance indices for schools. And you would do two things with those performance indices. You might hand out bonuses at the school level or at the teacher team level for performance. But you would certainly, and this is still an open research question. I haven't solved the math yet, but it's something I plan to work on in the future. You would certainly use the percentile performance index rankings for schools to, as part of a system that said, you know, you can't receive public funds anymore. It's been long enough that you've been in the bottom 5% or the bottom 3% or the bottom whatever percent. That's the hard part to figure out. How long you have to be how low to lose your right to receive public funding. And then if you made a commitment to that rule, and you also made a commitment to a process where you do need ed school people, I couldn't help you at all, which is serious evaluation of the resumes, the plans, the capacities of people who want to open new schools, so that you never authorize a new school, whether it's private, charter, or traditional public, unless the people who are going to be running it know what they're doing, or at least you have some reason to believe on paper that they know what they're doing. And then once you have that in place, you've got a menu. And you've got a menu of schools that are doing the academic part in a respectable way. And now you can hand out vouchers and you can let parents pick. And schools that don't receive a level of enrollment that is a certain fraction of what they have advertised as their target enrollment for a certain number of periods would also lose their right to receive public funding. Because the other thing that you don't want is you don't want schools that a small group of parents like, but not enough parents like to run the school at an efficient scale, keep receiving public money, because there'll be no way to cover the fixed cost of running the school and have enough money left over to really provide a decent education for the kids. So you've got to have two sets of rules. One is you close down the schools where parents want to go, but they shouldn't want to go because they don't really understand that the kids aren't learning anything. And then you close down the schools where no parent wants to send their kid there. And you could have, and then this whole chapter on the school assignment mechanisms, whether you use deferred acceptance or some other mechanism to let the parents express their preferences and then be assigned to schools, or whether you just make it like college and it's a market and they apply and they take who they want, or whether you have something in the middle, whether you have to have lotteries if you have oversubscription. The key is there have to be two sets of closing rules. You got to have the political will to close schools that parents want that are really performing terribly academically. And by close them, I mean cut them off from public funding. If they want to keep operating purely with private funds, well, okay. The other is you got to be willing to close schools that today may be doing okay academically, but their enrollment trends are such that it's clear we're going to a place where they're not going to be able to sustain it. Because they're losing enrollment and they're not going to be able to cover the fixed cost of running the school and provide adequate services.
So let me ask you like just one kind of a, you know, more so of the opinion.
And by the way, the first one's more important.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, you know, if there was a school that wasn't meeting its enrollment targets but had great performance, I would want to be slow to step in, okay? But most of the time, a school that's losing a lot of enrollment is going to have trouble keeping their test score performance up. And so you'll be able to forecast where things are going. And I'm just saying you don't want to wait until the measured performance has gone completely down the tubes to start saying you've got to step in here and do better, or you're in on a probation status where you might be losing your funding. The details of how you have those two conversations, where you go from warn to probation to close, no one has worked that out. And I'm not, and I think the big problem with choice is that no one has come up with the political will to actually do it. A big part of the book that I didn't know until I was working on this, even in Chile, the municipal government step in and prop up the failing local public schools. So there, I didn't find any example of a combination of choice and accountability anywhere in the world where local governments were just letting schools close or forcing schools to close for poor performance in significant numbers. And so that we've got to find a way to cross that bridge, or there's really no point in having choice. We'll just end up with a bunch of weak choice schools that are being propped up and kept open the way that we've always seen in traditional public schools.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. You mentioned the political will, and it's an interesting conversation I've had with some of the other people on this podcast. Is, you know, it seems like, you know, there was all of this energy, you know, No Child Left Behind, and that's in a lot of ways why I got into, you know, education policy and, you know, what drove me, because I saw a lot of things. I was working out a lot of details as a teacher and a grievance chairman. You know, and I've been reading quite a bit about Miami-Dade, and, you know, in the district there where, you know, they've increased choice. I don't know as much about the accountability measures that they've created, but, you know, you do look at this, and even in your backyard, you know, in the Chicago area on the south and the west side, you know, you have schools, high schools that are filled at 5%, 10%, 15%, and you know, we have significantly failing schools and underperforming schools, but then under-resourced schools because there's just not enough kids in them. You know, as you look forward, what would be, you know, if somebody's listening to this and somebody's reading the book and somebody's thinking about this differently, and, you know, I've been thinking about this for 15 years, and Dr. Glenn at Boston University really impacted me in a lot of the same ways, you know, choice and opportunities as well as the accountability systems. I don't know if this is even an appropriate question that you would even have ideas or thoughts about, but like, how do you even take a place where we had some political will and there was some energy behind it, and it seems like it's all dissipated, and now we're returning back to even prior to No Child Left Behind in a status quo from a status quo many years ago? Any suggestions for people listening or encouragements as people kind of read the book or think differently about some of this stuff?
Well, the phrase that gets repeated when I teach the class over and over and over again is details matter. And the people who were involved in setting up No Child Left Behind were just on this mission that we had to have test-based incentives. And whatever compromise you had to make with the political powers to get it through, they didn't care as long as we had test-based incentives. And so there, just a lot of the features of the way it was done, the way you kept score, holding every student to the same proficiency standard, putting this threat in that by 2014, if all students in all schools weren't proficient, we'd start closing schools, which doomed it from the beginning because, and I wrote this, you can look it up. I published this in 2010. I said, the whole thing's about to unravel because people are going to know. If they work in a school in Chicago, they're going to know that if they're 90% proficient in 2014, nobody's going to say a word to them because all the rest of the schools around them are going to be nowhere near 90%, and we're not going to close all the schools at once. And so once you know that the act contains manipulable standards, incentives for coaching and cheating, and threats that when we get near 2014 are not credible at all, the whole thing unravels from the end and falls apart. And it was very predictable that it would because it was designed in a way to be rhetorically appealing, but not really to make sense as an incentive system. So the first thing I would say is that if you're ever in a place where you have the political will to do something again, the details matter. And the details matter in choice systems as well. The details of how you authorize schools and how you invite schools to participate. The voucher system in Louisiana, if you read all the rules and you think about all the incentives, it was set up to attract low tuition, failing schools to participate. And they got what they paid for. And the other thing that you have to realize is the most unassailable result that comes out from all the research that's been done with different types of experiments is that you can bring in private schools and no excuses, charters, et cetera, and you can do at least as well as traditional public schools are doing, especially in large cities, for significantly less money. That whether it's because we're paying the union custodian $100,000 a year, or you know, you pick your favorite story, there's a lot of money being wasted in places like Detroit and Chicago and New York, et cetera. Okay? That's true. And what I think we have, and by the way, This has nothing to do with my research. I don't say this as a researcher. I say that because I can't prove this, but I say this as a cynical citizen of the United States. The problem that we have is we have one group politically on the left that does not really care about the economically disadvantaged kids that they claim to care about. They care about the middle class public employees that belong to the public employees unions that give them donations. And then on the other side, we have people that don't really care about disadvantaged kids. What they see is that if we can break these unions, we can provide the same bad education that we're providing now for 50 cents on the dollar. And I don't see any will in either party in any place to say, let's have real competition and let's fully fund it. Not some game where we have a voucher system and tell the voucher schools that they get, 50 cents on the dollar relative to the public schools. But a fully funded voucher system, and not like they do in Northern Europe, where you fully fund the voucher system and then say, and by the way, everybody has to belong to the National Teachers Union and work off the same contract. Fully funded vouchers and open competition, but with a commitment to monitor and test and assess and to take away authorization, take away the right to receive public funds from schools that don't perform or schools that no parents want to attend and they reach a level where it's clear they're not going to be able to cover their fixed costs, and you don't sit around and wait for them to have terrible performance many, many years in a row. And so I think that the problem we have is no one really cares about the kids that get left behind, except for people that are in these mission organizations that are running private schools or running No Excuses Charters Networks, et cetera. They don't have the political clout to break through what's going on in the power base of either party. So that's my speech, Eric. And by the way, that has a disclaimer. There's no scientific evidence I have to prove that I'm right about that. But that's my suspicion, is that we continue to have large numbers of children that are not college ready and not where they should be in a modern world because the power bases of both parties don't really care about them.
Dr. Neal, I mean, I really appreciate, I mean, your thoughtfulness on that, and I echo a lot of that in my, you know, professional experience and you know, my work, you know, even though, you know, those are things that as a researcher, you know, you can't necessarily prove, but I think there's, you know, the experience, the wisdom, and just the analysis of what we're watching. So I appreciate that wisdom. I appreciate this time. I appreciate your work. I appreciate the impact that you had on my life as a professional when I got to know you about, you know, 14, 15 years ago. And it's just a blessing to spend this time with you. And thank you very much for your thoughts, your expertise, and your wisdom today.
It was fun, Eric.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Bye, Dr. Neal.